No.
Wow.
Call the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee to order. Got a couple of new staff people. The committee page is Ariel Meal back here, and the committee intern is Rochelle Hayden. So we today we want to talk about the jobs issue. Recently, the legislative auditor came in with a report. I guess it's fair to say that there were kind of mixed mixed review and a lot of stuff that some things went well, and of course other things not so well, and that's, I guess, what we're going to be talking about today. And with the idea at the end of the day, I think that there will be legislation introduced this session, even though it's a short session, to fix up, if you will, some of the areas that we think need some working on. And I was going to say tweaking, but I think a little bit's more than tweaking. So we never want to. We're always looking to create jobs and new industries and move things forward, but if things aren't working just right, maybe we could correct things and continue on. But that's what we're going to be talking about today, the Jobs E, and some of the recommendations addressed by Deed. And we'll hear, first of all, from the auditor. John, why don't you step forward and... I think you were mainly responsible for this report. Is that correct? John Yunker from Project Manager, Legislative Auditor. Welcome to the committee. You may proceed in any way you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is John Yunker. I was the project manager for the study. David Kirchner in the audience here also worked with me on the study. As you said, some parts of the Jobs E program we gave kind of mixed reviews to. We did think that the program was successful in creating jobs in some cases, but we also thought that the program provided unnecessary or ineffective subsidies in other cases. And we felt that the program needs to be refocused. There needs to be an effort to try to be more strategic in deciding which businesses ought to participate in the program. We do think that the administration of the program has been weak. It's largely been in the hands of local governments, and that we found that there have been some very poorly written business subsidy agreements. And we also found that the Department of Employment and Economic Development's compliance monitoring process has been slow and sometimes ineffective. Finally, our report says that this program, although the statutes intended it to be targeted to economically distressed areas, it has not been targeted to those areas. It's been available throughout much of Greater Minnesota, and some distressed areas have not benefited much from the program. I'd like to just provide a little bit of background about the program and then get into our findings in more detail. As you know, the primary purpose of Jobs E is to increase economic activity in Greater Minnesota. And it attempts to do this by providing tax reductions to businesses locating in designated zones. Another purpose, as I alluded to just previously, was that the program was supposed to revitalize economically distressed rural areas. And to do this, Deed was supposed to use various need criteria that were in the 2003 state law that was passed, and use those criteria in determining where to locate zones. Regarding the taxes that are affected by this program, the program provides sales, income, corporate franchise, and property tax reductions. For the most part, there are a few exceptions. The reductions extend through the year 2015. The amount of tax reductions that have been provided so far has been doubling each year. It started out at about $6 million in 2004, went to $13 million in 2005, and $26 million in 2006. So for the first 3 years of the program, the total reductions have been about $46 million. And that's about $75,000 per year per business.
They have a formula or something.
I want to talk about some of the key features of this program because they're important to understanding how the program works. First of all, most of the costs in this program are borne by the state. They're tax expenditures. For the first 3 years of the program, 93% of the costs were state costs, 7% were local, and mostly involved the property tax. Now, we would expect the local share to grow some in future years, but we still expect the lion's share of the costs to come from the state. Secondly, this is a tax expenditure program. There is no cap on program activity. And what that means is there's really no need for local governments or DEED to set priorities as to who should participate in the program. Another important point here is that local governments have been making the key decisions. Local governments, even though it's mostly state money that's involved, have been deciding who is allowed to participate in the program and what they're required to do. The local governments negotiate the terms of business subsidy agreements with businesses, and those business subsidy agreements spell out how many jobs the business has to retain, create, and at what wage or benefit level, and when they have to create them. DEED has viewed this program primarily as a local program and something like tax increment financing, even though most of the costs are state costs. And as a result, DEED has provided little or no oversight, particularly about entry into the program. And another thing to be aware of with this program is that it's unlike any other enterprise zone programs or tax-free zones you might have heard of in other parts of the country. These are not compact zones and limited in number. There are over 1,150 subzones scattered throughout the state. They're fairly small in size. They're throughout most of Minnesota, and they're movable. When a business says to a local government, we'd like to locate here, and it's not in a zone, DEED and the local governments have been willing to move Job-Z subzones to where the business wants to go. So it's not like we're asking businesses to locate in particular zones. There's ability to move these zones to where the businesses want to go.
Mr. Yunker,
you say the state picks up a lot of the costs. What do they, the ad valorem taxes we forgive, does the state then kick back a portion to the school districts, or how does that work?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll just go
what
back.
Taxes are forgiven? Sales?
Go back to this slide. Yeah. We're talking about sales taxes, both on construction materials and supplies, as well as ongoing purchases of materials that are used in the business, are free from state and local
sales tax.
Yeah. To the extent that there is a local sales tax. Corporate franchise, business income, those sorts of things, whether they run through the corporate franchise tax forms or through the individual income tax forms, they are exempt from income taxes.
Zero.
I'd want to be a little more careful. There's a process for determining what exemption is provided.
Okay, then go on to the last one there. How does that work?
And, Mr. Chairman, then there are also property tax reductions, which are first of all, limited only to buildings. They do not apply to land. But you can get an exemption for the portion of the building that is in the zone. Sometimes only the expanded portion of a building is in a zone, not the entire building, but that's not always the case.
So they'll get that forgiveness for 17 years going forward? Real estate?
Mr. Chairman, it would be an exemption from paying any property taxes on those buildings, and it would last. The program started in 2004. The property tax exemptions, because of the way our property tax system works, go from 2005 through 2016, so as many as 12 years. But as businesses are coming into the program later, like, say, someone entered during 2008, they would only get exemptions through 2016, So they're going to have a reduced number of years for which they qualify, whether we're talking about property tax exemption or the sales, income, or franchise exemption.
How does it work where they could just – I'll quit talking a little bit after this, but a little bit. How does it work on the – they can just move a zone around? Or who can do that, just on their own? Or these zones weren't set up a couple of years ago when we did this or what? I got the impression, maybe nobody else did, but that you could kind of come in and move these things around a little bit. I don't know how that – how does that work?
Mr. Chairman?
You'd think the zones would be set up ahead of time, I would think, but maybe not.
Mr. Chairman, the subzones were set up ahead of time, but there's a process by which they can be modified. It requires deeds approval, and generally deed would first say to a city who wants to move some territory to where a business wants to locate, do you have acreage within your city that you can, you know, move from where it was to where that business is? In other words, swap within your own city. Next, they would look to within that region. But there have been cases where cities that didn't even have any subzone territory were able to participate in the program by getting property from someone else in that same region. So the zones are movable with deeds approval.
Okay, Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Yonkers. Now, the sales tax exemption, that would be a one-time exemption, but the income and the corporate for the state effect would be ongoing. Do you have a feel for what the split is on this, the $46 million of those, or is that in here?
Mr. Chairman.
Becker, I didn't see it, but is it in there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, there is a split in there. I would say it's probably in the first chapter of the report. On page 18 of the report, shows the sales tax on construction materials and the sales tax on ongoing purchases and also the other tax reductions and how much they've been in each of the first 3 years of the program. Typically, the construction materials one is going to be a one-time thing, although you could have some ongoing construction over time. There is a sales tax exemption, though, on ongoing purchases of materials that are used in the business. So it's sales tax exemptions are not just one time in general.
Senator Scoy.
And, Mr. Chair, well, that's interesting. But then do you have an expectation of, I mean, it's kind of doubled from 4 to 5 to 6, what we can expect going forward? I mean, I don't think it can continue to double, but do you have an increased feel for what that might be?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, we talk about that in the report. I think the estimate of $75,000 per business per year, I think, is something I don't think we're going to go below unless we have some significant economic downturn that reduces business income or business activity, employment. But exactly where we're going to go from here is not clear. It kind of depends on how many programs continue to enter the program, what you do with the program in terms of modifying it in the future.
Okay, we'll let you kind of move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Deed has measured the effectiveness and provided those kind of numbers on the Job Z program in annual reports that they've issued. And through the end of 2006, they're saying that the program has created close to 5,500 new full-time jobs, has helped retain about 4,500 jobs, and has resulted in capital investments of $1.3 billion. Those capital investments include not only purchases of land and building or construction of buildings, but also installation of equipment. We think that the deed numbers overstate the impact of Job Z. And there's three reasons why we think that. First of all, based on looking at unemployment insurance filings, where you can see how many employees a company has, we think that the employment at Job Z businesses is lower than what Deed reports. Secondly, Deed's numbers do not consider the fact that some of the growth that occurred at Job Z businesses would have happened even without Job Z. And that's substantiated by surveys that Deed does of participating businesses. And finally, Deed doesn't consider what subsidizing Job Z businesses does to competing businesses. Some of these businesses compete with other businesses in greater Minnesota, and employment at those businesses may be adversely affected by subsidizing the businesses that we do allow to participate in the program. I'd like to talk about this first factor. Deed's figures on how many jobs have been created are based on what we think is a flawed reporting form and process. What happens is that each year businesses report to local governments, who in turn then report to Deed on how many jobs were created or retained and what the wages were. And there is no certification by businesses of the accuracy of those figures. The form is confusing and allows double counting in some cases. And when you look at the unemployment insurance data, which the department has not done, it suggests that the increase in jobs at Job Z businesses is 20 to 30% lower in the aggregate than was reported by Deed. I also mentioned that some of the growth at Job Z businesses was not due to Job Z. If you look at the surveys that these businesses fill out after they sign up for the program, one-fifth of the businesses said that they would have expanded to the same extent that they did in greater Minnesota, even without Job Z. In other words, these were businesses that were going to expand. They had new customers. They had the business out there, and they had a reason to expand. And even without the tax subsidies, they would have expanded in greater Minnesota. Another 50% said that they would have expanded to some extent in greater Minnesota. Now, we don't know if they would have expanded 25% of what they actually expanded, or 50% or 75%, but they would have expanded to some extent, and it would have happened in greater Minnesota, even without the subsidies. Only about one-fourth of the businesses, participating businesses, said they would have expanded outside Minnesota if they hadn't gotten Job Z subsidies. The third reason I mentioned was that we said that Deed's numbers overstated the impact is because there are businesses that have participated in the program that have competitors in greater Minnesota, and those competitors could potentially be adversely affected by one of their competitors getting Job Z. Now, here are some of the more obvious examples. I think there are lots of other examples potentially that where it's not quite so obvious, but we have allowed a garbage hauler to participate in Job Z, an animal hospital, farm implement dealers, a construction company, an electrical contractor, architects, construction management firms, and so on. And before the legislature changed the law in 2005, we even had a public utility, an electrical cooperative, participate in the program. And that mainly this is happening because local governments, which are using primarily state money, have been allowed to make the decisions about what businesses can participate in the program. And they've been allowed to make those decisions with little or no state oversight. In particular, there is no requirement in the program that there be any evaluation of whether firms actually need the subsidy, whether they would expand with, would have done the expansion in greater Minnesota even without Job Z. There's also no consideration as part of the program, no policy that requires local governments or Deed to look at the impact on other greater Minnesota businesses or communities. In addition, there's little or no analysis of the statewide benefits and costs. As a result, we don't know. Are the promised jobs by a Job Z business commensurate with the cost of the subsidies received? No one takes a look at that. And finally, there's little consideration of whether more limited financial assistance would have been enough to get the business to expand in greater Minnesota. some local officials, some economic development officials locally told us that more limited financial assistance would often be sufficient to get the expansion. That Jobs E provides very substantial subsidies to the business and often isn't necessary, but that cities find it hard to turn down applications for Jobs E. After all, they don't pay most of the costs, so it really doesn't hurt them to make the decision that the business can participate. As I mentioned, we thought that the administration of the program was weak, and I'm going to highlight two particular areas. One, that there is no deed review of the terms of business subsidy agreements, the particulars of those agreements. And secondly, DEED does have a process for monitoring compliance with those agreements, but it's been slow and ineffective.
You want one?
Regarding the agreements, we found that some agreements have very minimal requirements. There's not much that the businesses have to do to meet the requirements of the agreements. Nearly half of the agreements required the businesses to create five or fewer jobs. 40 of about 350 agreements required the creation of one or fewer jobs. 15 agreements had no deadlines for creating jobs, so you would be required to create them, but it didn't say when you had to create them by. Theoretically, I suppose you could continue to receive the subsidies through 2015 since there was no deadline to create the jobs. Most agreements have deadlines, but we found that over 60 had no requirement to maintain newly created jobs through the year 2015. In other words, let's say you were required to create the jobs by within 2 years of the agreement. There was no requirement in the agreement that you maintain those jobs through the rest of the Jobs E term. So you, what you could do is create the jobs and reduce employment after that and still continue to receive the subsidies. We also found provisions inconsistent with state law in some of these business subsidy agreements, poorly worded provisions. DEED has a sample agreement which some cities use or some use to some extent, but we found problems with that agreement as well, and we noted that it doesn't seem like DEED has ever had an attorney look at that sample agreement. There's no definition in agreements of what an employee is. Does it include independent contractors as well as full-time employees? Does it include employees of temporary agencies that are hired by the Jobs E business? We don't know. How do you calculate a full-time equivalent employee? There's no definition in any of these business subsidy agreements that we found. And finally, there's no definition of what benefits are or fringe benefits when you go to calculating a wage and benefit package that's necessary to meet a certain requirement in the contract. How do you calculate benefits? Because there's a lot of different things that could be included in that. On the compliance monitoring process, DEED does have a process for reviewing the terms of business subsidy agreements and has actually removed a number of businesses from the program, and there's some statistics in Chapter 1 about that. But what we found is that it takes 1 to 2 years before they detect the noncompliance. It's a slow process. What this means is that in a handful of cases, some companies have received property tax exemptions that they should not have received. And I'll give you a dramatic example. There was a company that was required to construct a building and create so many jobs by the end of 2004. That company built the building but never created the jobs. Business plans changed, and those jobs have never been created. But the company received a property tax exemption on the building in both 2006 and 2007. There's a lot of confusion out there as to when those exemptions are to be removed, their slowness in the compliance process. These are things that need to be taken care of. As I said, the compliance monitoring process is based on this flawed reporting form and process, which doesn't require certification by businesses of the accuracy of the information provided. DEED has not used unemployment insurance data or reports to help them in looking at compliance. And as I mentioned, there's a lack of adequate communication from DEED to revenue and local tax officials. At least that's happened when some businesses have been removed from the program. I mentioned earlier that need was supposed to be a factor, or economic distress was supposed to be a factor in designating zones. But in the end, need really was not a factor in designating zones. What happened was that state law allowed the commissioner of deed to create 10 zones, but each of those 10 zones, though limited to 5,000 acres, could include an unlimited number of subzones. So what happened was deed and local governments worked to consolidate all the requests for Job Z into 10 applications. Those 10 applications were then rated, but because the for need and other criteria, but because the commissioner could award 10 zones, there was no need to use need or economic distress as a factor in whittling down the number of applications into 10 zones. What's happened because of this is that there are some economically distressed areas that have not benefited much from Job Z. They would include northeastern Minnesota, the Headwaters area, and the upper Minnesota River Valley. What economists tell us is economic benefits could be greater if Job Z were targeted to areas with higher unemployment rates and we were successful in reducing those unemployment rates. But that's not the way the program has operated. The report has about 33 recommendations, including 16 to the legislature, 13 to deed, and 4 to revenue. And I'm just going to highlight some of the key recommendations today. We think these first two recommendations are kind of the most important ones for legislative consideration. First of all, we think that the legislature should require deed to approve business subsidy agreements before they become affected. There is a need for state-level review of what's in these business subsidy agreements, how well they're written, and whether they're with businesses that should be participating in the program.
Mr. Yunker, could we, are these kind of highlighted on this sheet? Or is it? That's from Deed, but I'm wondering if they looked at your, and transferred them over to.
Mr. Chairman, this is the first time I've seen this.
All right, well, let's continue on. I think they talk about some of the same things. Maybe that's what we're going to hear from them a little later. Go ahead.
Yeah.
The second recommendation that we think is essential here is that the legislature place a cap on annual program activity. Without some sort of cap, there's no need for deed to set priorities or for local governments to set priorities. What we envision is perhaps a cap on the number of projects or a number of businesses that are allowed to participate or to enter the program each year. An alternative would be to cap the estimated cost of future subsidies for businesses that are entering the program each year. It wouldn't be a cap on the actual subsidies they receive, but on some estimate of what they are expected to receive over the lifetime participation in the program. We also think that the legislature should require deed to develop and implement criteria for participation in the program and should consider targeting the program to economically distressed areas. Our recommendations to deed kind of mirror these first some of the things that we've already talked about. The first two here, we're really asking deed to play a more active role in determining which businesses participate in the program and what's required of them. What are the specific terms in their business subsidy agreements? And the last four recommendations on this slide pertain to the compliance monitoring process. We're saying that deed needs to streamline and shorten and improve the compliance monitoring process. And there are also some recommendations in the report for revenue. They're not quite as significant. There are some key things, though, because we did find an error in their Job Z tax schedule in how a cap is applied to exempted business income, and we think that needs to be corrected. What they were doing didn't correspond to statutory provision. So we think there are some things that revenue needs to do as well. Mr. Chairman, that's the end of my presentation. I'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee has.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Junker.
Chairman.
I'll see the reaction. I know the department or departments have had a little bit of time because I think your audit report was with last week to the Legislative Audit Commission. And of course, they haven't had a lot of time, but anyway, we'll find out from the department what they're doing about these, and they're kind of serious problems. It looks like a number of them are quite serious. And I've talked to a couple of senators, including Senator Rosen, who I think they're digging into some of these things and going to take a long, hard look, and maybe we can. Well, that's why you're here. You know, we want to do things right, and if it takes some fixing up, we'll look at that. Senator Tomasoni, did you have a...
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Junker, you mentioned competition with existing businesses already. Did you find that there was any movement of businesses from non-job Z zones into job Z zones, or the movement of job Z zones into where businesses already were so that they would qualify? Did any of that happen?
Mr. Junker.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, if you look on pages 29 and 30 of the report, there's a couple pie charts here that talk about, you know, what kind of businesses have participated in the program, and then regarding the businesses that have relocated within Minnesota, where they've come from. The pie chart on page 29 shows you that the most frequently we've either got a business that's expanding or a business that's relocating within Minnesota. So a little more than a third of all the businesses were in the expansion category, a little more than a third were in this relocating within Minnesota category. Very few of the businesses are moving in from another state, 6% in this pie chart. If you flip to the other pie chart, this speaks to those businesses that are relocating in Minnesota and where did they come from. And in the lion's share of cases, they came from the same city. Now, does that mean that they're using the program to, you know, let's move the job Z zone to where we want to locate, and they're just using the program, they didn't really need it? It may in some cases, it may not in other cases. But we do know that in a lot of cases, 61% of the time, that they're not moving very far. They're moving from the same city, and another 20-some percent of the time, they're moving from very close by. They're moving from a nearby city within 50 miles. So most of the businesses that are relocating within the state are not moving very far.
Question.
Senator Saltzman.
And wait, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me.
Let me follow up here. And the new, so the new businesses are a very minimal part of what this whole thing has been about. And for the most part, what you've found out is that a lot of the expansion may have occurred regardless of whether this job Z was here or not. And many of the benefits of job Z were a result of relocation, which means they probably wouldn't have gone anywhere anyway. Is that a good conclusion?
Mr. Junker.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, that's kind of a tricky question because I do think some of those that relocated within Minnesota might not have expanded but for job Z. Similarly, I think that's true of the expansions or the new businesses. But the same token, there's some businesses that would have done the same thing without job Z, and they're in different categories here. This is just another way of looking at things, and it does tend to make you believe that tax subsidies are more important in the tax literature supports this. They're more important in deciding where businesses are going to locate within a particular region rather than in terms of getting them to move across state lines.
And let me ask just one last question, Mr. Chairman. And just so I understand this part of it, it sounded like the agreements that have been signed, in some cases, the businesses did not perform up to the expectations. Were the is the job Z set up in such a way that if you agree to do something, you get the benefit immediately, or do you have to actually perform before you get the benefit? In other words, if you agree to do 10 jobs within the next year, you start getting tax benefits immediately, or do you start getting the tax benefits after you put the 10 jobs in?
Yucker.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, you get the benefits immediately, and those benefits are not removed unless you're removed from the program. And what we also pointed out is that there have been some cases where the company should have been removed from the program. It took a long time to do that, and they got some benefits that they shouldn't have gotten.
So I think that's obviously it's going to have to be one of the things of many that we have to look at if this goes forward. Senator Saltzman.
Yes. A quick question, Mr. Chair, is in looking at this, is there any data that looks at what kinds of jobs Job Z was targeted to? I know that we've had a lot of discussion over the interim on some of the emerging technologies that are happening in Minnesota. How can we compete? Is there anything in this program that looks at or starts to address what kind of jobs the Job Z zones were used for?
Mr. Chairman, Tucker. Senator Saltzman. The program doesn't specifically say that it should be used for certain types of jobs, but two-thirds of the jobs have been in manufacturing areas, which is probably good, although that in and of itself doesn't guarantee that the subsidy was needed either. We've had some manufacturers take advantage of the program that would have made their expansion anyway. But I would say it's good that the program is more concentrated in that area than in certain other areas. Does it target specific segments of the economy or technology? I don't believe it does.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, one last one.
Mr.
Yonkers, is there a pay scale or a benefit level or both that these jobs need to reach in order to qualify for Job Z, or is it minimum wage to $15 an hour, or what? I mean, is there anything in there that says how good these jobs have to be in order to qualify?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, since about mid-2005, there was a legislative requirement passed that the wage and benefit package had to at least meet a certain level. It's a level based on the federal poverty level for a family of four. And my recollection is that level is somewhere on the order of $11 an hour, $10.92 per hour, including both wages and benefits not required by law. Right, and it goes up as the federal poverty level goes up over time. But that's the only specific requirement for all participants in the program. Cities can implement, and some have, higher requirements for particular businesses.
Senator Rosen. Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Mr. Yonker. There's also the requirement for any expansion in the same location, what is it, 20% of the square footage or employee base? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, the program started out with a requirement that you either increase your number of jobs by if you relocated within Minnesota. That it doesn't apply to other situations, but if you relocated operations within Minnesota, you had to increase the number of jobs by 20% or make a capital investment equal to 10% of, and I'm blanking on the specific figure. Mm-hmm. Most of those companies early in the program chose the capital investment, which was somewhat minimal. And as a result, the legislature in 2005 said, forget the capital investment requirement. We want you to increase the number of jobs by either 20% or 5 jobs, whichever is more. Because some of the businesses were increasing the number of jobs by 1. And, of qualifying that way. But this only applies to those businesses that are relocating within Minnesota.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Younger, on that diagram on page 30 and the 61% in the same city, I guess my question is actually two. Some of that expansion could be of that 61% if they were thinking of relocating out of the state and they decided to move into a Job Z subzone. Or, that's a question, if that could happen. Or is some of that because of the Rochester and St. Cloud and I believe Mankato being allowed to participate in the program? Is it broken down into specific categories?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, first of all, I don't think it has anything to do with Rochester, Mankato, or certain cities. This is kind of the pattern across the state that a lot of these relocations have occurred either from within the same city or from a nearby city. I was very careful when Senator Tomasoni asked this question because I would not necessarily conclude that because the location occurred from within the same city that this was a business that didn't need Job Z. It could be a business that would have moved somewhere else had it not gotten Job Z.
And Mr. Chair.
Rosa.
Mr. Younger, you said something about on your business subsidies agreements, said some agreements have. And can I just assume then there are different agreements by different subgroup managers, that there isn't one PAT agreement, one PAT form, or I guess I'm a little confused about that.
Mr. Younger.
All different?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, there is a sample agreement that Deed has provided to cities. As we said, we found some problems with that agreement, and it's one that apparently was never reviewed by an attorney. Cities are free to write whatever agreement they want. There is no requirement that they use Deed sample agreement, and so you find some cities have used it in part or in full, and some have written their own agreements. Sometimes there's been problems. I'll tell you one example that I thought was rather humorous was that there was a company that was going to both create jobs and retain jobs. And in the deeds, they were using that city was using the deed sample agreement, and it said that the company would retain, and the deed agreement said, insert here the number of retained jobs. And the business subsidy agreement says, insert here the number of retained jobs. They never inserted the number of retained jobs. It just has the deed boilerplate agreement mm-hmm. there. So cities are not being careful enough in writing these agreements, and there's no state oversight and review of the agreements.
I think, Senator Gimsey, but I believe we'll get on to the we got the OLA recommendations, and Deed is, I jumped my head at myself before a little bit, but I think Deed is agreeing to do a lot of the recommendations that the auditor is, the questioner has put forward. So we'll hear from them. And, for example, the one you just mentioned, Senator Rosen, should require that Deed approve all subsidy agreements. Well, apparently it's been a loose agreement, so not the best form or something, but that seems to probably be addressing that one, for example. And you go down that list and what the recommendations are, but that's who we're going to hear from now. But because we got to clean this up, and we all know there's some problems out there. But did you have a question before we have Mr. McElroy and Mr. Ines up? Mr. Gimsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I haven't had an opportunity to read the report completely, but is there a section in there that shows where companies who have projected, say, creating 10 jobs through this program have actually created 25 or 50 and gone above what the requirement was? I know of a number of examples where this program has been tremendous in communities as far as going beyond mm-hmm. What was originally promised. Is there some place where that information is laid out in the report?
Yeah, Mr. Younger.
Chairman, Senator Gimsey, You know, I said the deeds numbers said they would have created about, that they've created about 5,500 new jobs. Deed would like to have had us say that, and I think their annual report says that the businesses had a goal of about 4,500 or 4,600 new jobs, and they in total created 5,500. So obviously some have more than met their goals. The problem, though, is that, as I said, that for the companies we were able to look at their unemployment insurance forms, we're saying that those new jobs are not 5,500 jobs. They're 20 to 30% lower. And so for us to say they've that in aggregate the program has created more jobs than the goals that were set for the business is problematic, because we really think, based on the unemployment data, that they've in aggregate created less jobs than what the goals were.
But I think
some businesses, individual businesses, though, have obviously created more.
I think that was Mr. Gibbs's. I can't speak for him, but I think what he was saying, that there are success stories too. You know, it's not all gloom and doom, that there's at least pockets of good results. So, but that's not to say we can't do better and improve on the regulations and rules and what have you. But with that, I think, Senator Carlson, did you wish to comment?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Younger, I have one small compliance question. When you mentioned, you gave the example, for instance, of that the building that was built and the subsidies that were given, but then the company did not comply with the agreement. And I noticed on page 23, it talks about when a business ceases to operate in a zone or fails to meet the requirements of the business subsidy agreement, they must repay the tax benefits they received. Are there examples of that, those clawbacks happening? And in the case of that building that was built, were those subsidies reclaimed by the state when the business did not live up to their agreement?
Mr. Chairman,
Tucker.
Senator Carlson, there have been businesses removed from the program by deed. That happened primarily in the spring of 2007. It's a little early to say what clawbacks have occurred. Maybe Department of Revenue could speak more to that, but that was in the process or in the works while we were doing the study, and so we don't comment on that extensively. This particular company and a few others did receive some property tax benefits that have not been clawed back, and I'm not sure they can be clawed back because of the way the laws are written and because of the slowness in the process. And so what we're saying in the report is speed up the compliance process, and also suggesting to the legislature to modify the provisions particularly pertaining to property taxes, so that if a business is determined to have been noncompliant and out of the program as of, in this particular case, the end of December 2004, that they have to have those property tax benefits clawed back to the extent that they received them after that date.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. It was very enlightening. I think at this point we'd like to bring Commissioner McElroy to the table and any staff that he might want with him. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. If Commissioner Innes could join me, we can sort of work together to address issues that fall with our various departments. First of all, let me thank John, his staff, and the Office of the Legislative Auditor. They did their jobs. The Legislative Audit Commission asked them to evaluate the program. It's a relatively new program. It's 4 years old. Interestingly enough, when they presented this to the Legislative Audit Commission, they presented evaluations on two tax programs, one called Green Acres that has been around for 40 years, and they found a fairly significant number of opportunities to improve that, and one, Job Z, around 4 years, and also found opportunities to improve that. And we take this as I'm old enough to remember when Henry Kaiser was a business leader in the United States. He did Kaiser Motors and Kaiser Aluminum and Kaiser Concrete and the Kaiser Permanente Medical Foundation, lots of other things. He talked about his experience during World War II, that he found that problems were just opportunities in work clothes, and so that we see these as opportunities to make an already good program dramatically better. And I want to take Senator Gimsey's lead in saying there have been some terrific success stories, and but for those, communities would be less well off today than they would have been without Jobs 8. And we're proud of all of them. But some of them are notable. Suzlon Wind Energy made a decision to have a United States presence after visiting many states. They elected, after analyzing Jobs 8, proximity to I-90 and other highways, robust market for wind turbine blades in Minnesota, the likelihood that we would pass a mandate in Minnesota, to build a 150,000-square-foot facility in Pipestone. The job subsidy agreement was signed in 2005. They committed to 23 jobs. By the time they built the plant, they predicted they would have 250 jobs. As of last Wednesday, we talked to them. They had 450 jobs, and they've committed to have 700 jobs by July 1st of 2008, both to themselves and to their customers. They were hesitant to let me talk about the wage levels, but they said they were dramatically higher than are required by law. My job center staff said they are extremely competitive in southwestern Minnesota and include the best benefits that they have seen in that region. Another, I think, outstanding example is a company called Daktronics that expanded from Brookings, South Dakota, to a then-vacant facility in Redwood Falls in the summer of 2000. And actually, they signed their agreement in December of 2006 and moved in early 2007. They now occupy 7 buildings in Redwood Falls. They committed to 50 jobs, and as of last Wednesday, they had 227, and have announced that they will continue to expand during the balance of this year. A company called IRACOR in Hibbing was a new business started by an existing business, by Hibbing Rubber Products. IRACOR lines pipe needed for the very corrosive tar sand oil recovery in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and probably in the Blandin Basin of North Dakota because of the acidity of the oil that comes from the ground. They had an agreement with a city in Montana to build a facility. They heard about Job Z. They were approached by the city of Hibbing. They committed at that time to 20 jobs. They're above that today. I was not able to reach them this morning to get a number, but we know as of last December, they were in the range of 50 jobs, and they continue to do well. That's not to say that there haven't been some projects, if we had had the authority to say no to, that we wouldn't have said no. We don't have that authority under – let me make it clear. In order to assert that authority, it probably would have been necessary to litigate because the communities feel that this is either a local project or a local state partnership and feel a great deal of local control, and I understand that. We think that we should continue to have a strong local voice, but that a statewide vision would be appropriate. So we created a kind of response document. It's just an outline. As John indicated, they made 16 suggestions, 16 recommendations for improvement. We combined some of them. Some of them we can do on our own authority, and we're going to do those as quickly as is humanly possible. I'll give you some idea of how quick some of that is. The ones that really make a difference, however, require legislative authority or legislative clarification. And so let me just walk through this blue sheet, if I may. We agree with all but one of John's recommendations. One we have some concerns about. I wouldn't say we disagree, but some of them we're kind of passionate about. And this idea in Section 1, Number 1, we would like to approve subsidy agreements, both as to form and substance. We'd also like to have the ability to comment and potentially to say no, but we want a strong local voice. We don't think substituting our experience for the experience of local economic development professionals or city councils or mayors is a good idea, but that it should be a partnership, more of a partnership than it is today. We are developing some clear and specific criteria that would include disclosing competitors, addressing some of the but-for test questions, disclosing if communities have had development proposals from other states or countries. To make that mandatory, however, we're going to need legislative authority, or we're going to need to use our I'm going to call it rulemaking, although we're exempt from the Procedures Act, the Administrative Procedures Act. We would have to declare policies and then defend them, and I think we're much more likely to get a good result with local partners if we have legislative concurrence. Third, that we will assure business subsidy agreements include meaningful goals. We will do that. We did that effective last week. In order to make those goals binding, we need legislation. We will use our bully pulpit. We will persuade. We will consult. But we, in order to be able to set binding goals, Now, to review business subsidy agreements for language and substance, we can do that today, and we will do that. But to say that the minimum is 5 jobs or 10 jobs or 20 jobs, we would be pushing our authority, we believe, to do that. Would likely get litigated. It would be better to do it in legislation. Number 4, a uniform mandatory subsidy agreement. We are in the process of rewriting the subsidy agreement. It needs some work. But to make a single agreement mandatory is going to require, we think fairly clearly requires legislative authority. To have a better sample, we'll do that within, hesitant to give you a number, but probably within 30 days, we will consult with the Attorney General to improve the sample. But to make it binding and mandatory, we need your help. One of the things we want to do in that, John mentioned on numerous occasions that we should have used unemployment insurance data. A couple of problems with that. First of all, unemployment insurance data is technically non-public data. And although within the department we'd have the authority to use it, and we'd be, I think, in compliance with U.S. Department of Labor regulations, we've been hesitant to use information provided by a company for one purpose, for a clearly different purpose, without having told them that we were going to do that. We will include in the new business subsidy language the disclosure that we and by signing a business subsidy agreement, a company will agree to having their unemployment insurance data used to verify their employment, and will get their employment identification number, the EIN. It is not surprising to us that the legislative auditor had some difficulty getting them to match, because to some extent they're done for different purposes. If, for example, about 2/3 of our employers use a contractor like Talks or ADP or others to report the data, and we work with them constantly to have it be as accurate as we would like. Some companies move or have multiple doing business as or multiple locations and are not as rigorous about getting people in the right places as we would like. We think by inserting strong language in the business subsidy agreement, we can correct that problem. But we have we see some shortcomings in the approach of using existing unemployment insurance data to verify something for which it wasn't intended. Number 5 is that we'll consider project cost benefits and competitors in our but-for analysis. If someone commits to spending $1 million and creating 20 jobs, what kind of is that sufficient value to justify the amount of the tax return? We can do that calculation. We don't have the authority to make it binding on local units of government yet, but we would recommend that we disclose that to them. We give them the analysis as quickly as we're able to develop it so they can discuss it with their economic development boards, the board of directors of their economic development entities, with their city councils, but it wouldn't be binding currently. The second section are things where we do have more authority without legislation, and those are reliance or reporting and compliance issues. We're going to separate what's now called the Minnesota Business Assistance Form to a different form, a Job Z form that's specifically for Job Z, and we'll tie the dates that it's submitted to goals and business subsidy agreements. We'll have that ready in paper form within 30 days. The electronic form will take longer because there's some programming to do to make it submittable online, but we're working on that already. We are already having conversations with revenue about how to streamline compliance review and improve linkage to dates in the subsidy agreements. One of the suggestions, I don't think we put it on here, but that Mr. Junkers made, is to provide some penalty for communities that don't provide us the information or don't cooperate. I'm not sure what an appropriate penalty is. Commissioner Innes may have some suggestions, or John may have some ideas. But there are some cases where we have difficulty getting cooperation, and some incentives for cooperation would be helpful. Third, the legislature should require businesses to attest to the accuracy of their business subsidy agreements. To some extent, this is a DOR issue, Department of Revenue issue, but we want to applaud that. That would be incredibly helpful to us. We think it's exactly the right thing to do. In hindsight, I wish we had suggested it a couple of years ago. We didn't. It will be very helpful.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Chairman, Commissioner, I brought this up in one of my questions. It seems to me that these businesses should not get Job Z benefits until they've actually created the jobs, not a promise to create the jobs. And I think that's a pretty good recommendation, just because why would you have to create the jobs if you're already getting the benefit? And then I realize you're supposed to pay it back, but That might be one of these compliance things that you might have a problem with, and I think that could be a really good revision. And I don't know if it needs, I don't think it needs legislation, but it could possibly need legislation to say you have to comply with the, and maybe even make it mandatory that you keep those jobs for a certain number of years before, or else you lose, you lose the benefit completely. But
Commissioner?
Chairman. Senator Tomasoni, I'm rather certain we would need legislation to make that change. Commissioner Innes can comment on that in a second. One of my concerns is that one of the benefits that enables companies to expand in a more expensive fashion than they may have been able to otherwise is the upfront deduction of the sales tax. Right now, or the upfront exemption from the sales tax. And we're working with a number of companies for whom that is the biggest issue because their banks will count that as equity in the transaction. In terms of the income tax, ongoing sales tax, property tax, I don't see it being a problem that you have to meet your goals before those benefits kick in. And we certainly intend to put in the, our sample business subsidy agreement and in a mandatory agreement, if we get that authority, that jobs would be continued for the life of the tax benefit. It doesn't make sense to have get to your job goal within 2 years and then fall backwards. I don't think that was the intent of the legislature, but the language, we would likely end up in litigation if we had tried to enforce that without legislative intent. But if I could go on, I'm not sure if attesting and certifying is exactly the same thing, but we really like number three in section two, think that's incredibly important. We did include a penalty for local governments. And I don't know what's appropriate. Maybe no real big deal is required. Local governments, we should discuss that. I know some representatives of local governments want to testify today and are likely to want to testify as this process continues. But there have been a handful of local governments that have been slow to help us. Number five, authorize the state auditor. We're very supportive of that. We've been state auditor has some limited authority today. There are limits to what they can do because of the Data Practices Act. We support the idea of giving them the authority, certainly to have access to unemployment data. That data will get better when we have a provision in the business subsidy agreement requiring employee identification numbers and advising employers that we're going to be providing it to the state auditor and that it will be audited. Number six, that we'll use UI data and other methods to validate job C employment. We'll build that into the new business subsidy agreement. We will try to do it retroactively. We may face some problems with that. Hopefully not. And then seven, we'll provide better and more timely information about JobZ businesses and compliance. We're already having discussions with the Department of Revenue about how we can tie together our systems. We will be sending a letter shortly to zone administrators and sub-administrators explaining the concerns the legislative auditor had, urging them to read the legislative auditor's report, and asking for their more timely provision of information. And then in the third section about program activity, that the legislature should act a business or dollar cap on JobZ, we certainly will work with that. There's one example I can think of where the federal government has done that, and that's by setting a quota for industrial revenue bond financing. The challenge is that you either end up funding kind of first come, first served, whether it would be best come, best served or not, or you end up kind of, quote, wasting allocation at the end of the year or using it for your low priority things. We would be, we're looking forward to hearing the input from cities and regional economic developers on this recommendation. We have some concerns about it. We certainly understand why the legislative auditor is recommending it. Secondly, the legislative auditor should consider extending the program benefits to at least 10 years. We have recommended in the governor's JobZ proposal that subsidy agreements entered into by 2015 be for 10 years in counties that have had economic growth and for 12 years in what we're calling targeted economic development counties, which are counties that have either had significant population decline or high unemployment or both. That would be one approach. We have not been supportive. We have concerns about eliminating entire counties. And one example of a county about which we have concerns is Stearns County, because the income in eastern Stearns County, which is St. Cloud, is very high, and in western Stearns County, which is Holdingford and Avon and other communities, is dramatically less than it is in the county seat. And if we elect to eliminate counties, that's going to be an issue, and I think you'll certainly hear from communities about that, and we'll look forward to that discussion. And finally, the legislature should consider targeting the program to economically distressed areas. We support that. We'll have to work with you as a smart way to do that. Our approach to doing it was to provide a longer duration in economically distressed counties and a shorter duration in prosperous counties. That's probably not the only way. That's certainly not the only way to approach it. We may also want to consider using cities as the differentiator rather than counties because of the Stearns example. We're holding for it is a lot different than St. Cloud. However, St. Cloud also provides jobs for people who live in Holdingford and Avon and a variety of other communities. And so it isn't as simple as the issue sounds. With that, Mr. Chairman, if I could turn to Commissioner Innes to comment on behalf of the Department of Revenue, then we'd look forward to the opportunity to take some questions.
Certainly.
Welcome, Chairman. Commissioner. My name is Ward Innes, representing the Department of Revenue. And I first and foremost just want to commend the legislative auditor, and specifically, John, Mr. Junkers, on the quality of the report. The Department of Revenue concurs with all the findings and recommendations relating to the Department of Revenue. We've done our best to work diligently to remedying those that we can without legislative action. The rest of those we'll have to wait. Even prior to the issuance of this report, we were working on some Job Z legislation. One thing we think is really imperative is what Commissioner McElroy touched on, is certification by the businesses in the zone that they are in compliance with the Job Z agreement. Right now, we put all the onus on local units of government. You know, these small towns and cities don't have the wherewithal, the staffing to monitor on an ongoing basis the compliance of these Job Z businesses. So I think we really got to put the onus on the business. And it will be a very strongly worded certification, easy to fill out. It'll just be simple and straightforward. We promise X number of jobs at Y wage and certain level of capital investments that are required. They will certify that on an annual basis. Failure to certify that is grounds for being immediately removed from the zone. And if they, we also find if they materially misrepresent their status, they also have, there's a penalty provision. So I think that's strong. Put some teeth in it to put the onus where it belongs, which really is on the beneficiary business that's benefiting. So we would strongly embrace that recommendation. We also think the M500 form should be mandatory. Right now, we do our best to get taxpayers to submit that form. It's not required under law, and so the vast majority do comply. But having a penalty or some kind of legal requirement would be very helpful. And we've corrected. John mentioned that there was a flaw in our corporate tax form regarding the calculation of the Job Z benefit. We have corrected that. We've gone back and audited the different businesses that were potentially impacted. So far, there were 40 businesses that were potentially impacted by that error in our form. We have found nobody actually who was actually impacted. So we're going to notify the remainder businesses to make sure no one send them out new forms and information, and so they get the full benefit of the corporate tax calculation. Another thing we embraced last year was having the state auditor have access to the private tax information. We think that's important, and the legislative auditor has access to those. So we have having more than one entity, I think, is helpful in looking at the program and making sure it's delivering the benefit that's all been promised. You know, one thing I was working on this legislation back in the governor's office, and there was a lot of discussion about this legislation, about what the balance should be between local control and state oversight. And at that time, we really did err on the side of more local control. This was a local economic development tool. If a region of the state wanted to utilize it, it should be their call. If they didn't want to utilize it or market it, they wanted to use more traditional economic development tools like tax increment financing, that was their option. So at that point, we initially drafted legislation. We clearly made a decision with legislative input that the local should be the driving force behind this program. I think experience has shown us that maybe we need to recalibrate that balance. And I still think the locals need to play a prominent role, maybe the primary role. But the state, I think we've learned, I think the state and the Department of Economic Development really needs to have more of an oversight function. We concur with that recommendation. The locals, I think, have done their level-headed best to use the program in a reasonable, strategic way. There's always exceptions. You have 300 Job Z deals out there. There's always going to be a few that you scratch your head and say, what were they thinking using it this way? And also, I think it's important to emphasize that every year since this bill has passed, we've come back and fine-tuned the legislation, tried to improve. We, issues arise that you weren't aware of, unintended consequences, we've gone back. You know, initially retail was frowned upon, but it wasn't explicitly prohibited in the law. So we came back in 2004. We made that change. We made the change so a utility can't take advantage of the Job Z program. We've made
tightened relocation.
We tried to tighten the relocation criteria. So you know, every year we've been willing to go back and revisit it to make the program better than it previously was, and we're more than willing to do that once again. So we look forward to working on it.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just make one other point. For a variety of reasons, not anticipating this audit, but because of a need to provide different resources, we reorganized at Deed starting in August of last year and finished, hired the right person in October to create a specific unit that deals with Job Z. We now have, I believe, five professionals and a couple of support people in a unit called Job Z and Business Finance. We hadn't had that before. The Job Z administration was done by people whose principal job was to do contaminated sites cleanup, the redevelopment fund, Brownfields Petro Fund, and it was additional duties to them. We now have a team whose principal job is Job Z and other business finance programs. We think that'll make a huge difference. Mr. Chairman.
Well, just the obvious thing is to keep this program alive and kicking. We have to certainly make some major adjustments, and I think that's what the testimony I've heard with you two in front of us this afternoon. But it is a short session. I don't know if you got one bill or many bills or how it's coming through. I haven't seen anything, quite frankly, but again, that there's major repairs to be done if we're to keep this alive, and I happen to think it can work. It will work if we, and it has worked in some instances, but there's been some problems. So get the language drafted, and I suppose you got to come back here, and we'll hear, but you got to be soon. I mean, the deadlines are coming up, so I know you're working on this stuff. Senator Rosen, I know you've been involved in some of this. Yeah, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I was one of the first co-authors with Senator Bach the first year that this brought out, so I've been working on this for a long time. And it is obvious, as you said, Mr. Chair, that we need to work on this to make sure that it's working effectively as the goal of the program from the very beginning. And it obviously has. There's, I'm sure, some debate whether it's worth it, but there's four senators right here, five potentially, that could say yes, it has worked out in greater Minnesota. My question, and if you could just briefly tell us how this would work with the governor's seed program, if it's supposed to complement each other.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, we look at economic developers as using a toolbox and needing a variety of tools. And in the past, they've had tax increment financing, job skills partnership, and Job Z, and that was about it. SEED seeks to add about 18 other tools in areas like more help from the small business development centers, more help for applying for federal grants, more help with the community job creation plans. We're trying to add more tools to the toolbox, and the changes recommended here fit without any problem with the governor's recommendations for strategic entrepreneurial economic development.
Senator.
Okay.
Well, just Mr. Smith, did you wish to? I promised the minority leader that we'd get you up here if you'd like to. All right, do you have a success story, or do you,
Mr. Chairman? Before they get up, before.
Pardon?
Just before these guys leave.
Yeah. You're not done yet, I guess. I tried to get you out of here, commissioners, but they're both my dear friends, so we. Go ahead, Senator Tomasoni.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, you called this hearing because the report by the auditor is pretty serious, I think, and some of the things that have happened in regards to this are very, very concerning to me, and I'm willing to give you another try at this, but I think we got, I mean, you've got some major reforms that need to be done within the department to make sure things are working in this Job Z thing, and I don't think it's just a matter of saying, well, a couple of things probably wouldn't go right when you have 300 some Jobs Z businesses coming in, and so I'm very concerned that we get something put together that will change the way this thing operates, and that the deed oversight of these job as these is much stronger than what it has been in the past, because I'm terribly concerned that it's not doing exactly what it was meant to do, and that it needs a lot more oversight and more than just fine-tuning.
Yeah, and let me just, and maybe I hope I wasn't misunderstood, but I didn't mean to tweak or fine-tune. We're going to, there's some major stuff here, and I agree with you, Senator, and it's got to come back here, and we got to do it right. So if I kind of lighten the load, I didn't mean to do that, because there's serious stuff.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomsoni, we agree with that.
Yeah.
And some of them are kind of the principal philosophies. Do you want to give our department the authority to say no? And if you do, we'll use it where it's appropriate. We will also try to provide more technical assistance, and we've now rearranged people, and we'll make the resources available so that there is oversight. We agree that there needs to be some changes. We also see opportunities. Some of the program or projects that are being worked on, Senator Tomsoni, in your corner of the state, have been the economics have been analyzed with the hope that at least some of them would qualify for Job Z. I don't know if the
we're
economics.
We're not putting Minnesota Steel in Job Z.
I couldn't quite hear that.
You didn't want to hear it.
I'm delighted to hear that. There are some that are a little more fragile than that, where it may be appropriate. And it is one of the issues is to create so that kind of the actualization matches expectations. And I'm concerned if there's been an expectation that you can do an animal hospital or an architectural office with Job Z, that's not appropriate. But I also think if we get the opportunity for a major manufacturing expansion where the original work was done with that in mind, we need to do it right, but that we shouldn't remove those opportunities. But we agree, Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomsoni, that this is beyond fine-tuning, that it is some philosophical changes that are needed.
We're going to try to get Northwest Airlines and Delta into this mix here. So. No,
just all
the budget.
Mr. Chairman, I concur with everything you said. I think we also got to put some perspective on this. As you know, Commissioner Macro was mentioning, there was two legislative audit reports done about the same time, Green Acres and Job Z. If you look at the Green Acres program, that delivers a $60 million tax benefit per year to the state of Minnesota, to residents in the state of Minnesota. This one's about 25 to 30. So that Green Acres program, it's kind of flown under the radar for 40 years without any kind of serious legislative review. The tax benefit to that is twice as much as we give out for Job Z. And so I think, you know, this program has taken a lot. It's a high-profile program. It's, you know, kind of the governor's flagship as far as economic development. But look at the Green Acres report. Twice as many tax dollars going on under that program with minimal, little.
I would encourage everybody to look at the Green Acres. It started out a pretty good idea. That's a whole other day. All right, Mr. Smith, is it? I promised a minority leader would. You're president of the Rochester Area Economic Development. Have you used this tool? And
we have.
What you're going to talk about?
We have.
And make it, if you could do it in 4 or 5 minutes
I'll
or something.
I'll be brief. I'll be very brief. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, to be here today and give you a local perspective. And I know Rochester's case is debated up here quite often as related to Job Z, but I wanted to do one thing, leave you with the impression. I wouldn't want you to make the false assumption that everything will be great in Rochester forever. If all we ever do is depend on Mayo and IBM, you know, we do pretty well, and we're thankful to have Mayo and IBM there. They're great employers and great contributors to the state economy. But we hope to grow beyond those two businesses and those two industries. And one way we can do that is by utilizing the Job Z program. We have used it on a minimal basis. We are currently, we concur with the Office of Legislative Audits report here from a local perspective. This program does need to be have major improvements made to improve the effectiveness and the quality of it. The good news is that with a well-set, defined set of measurements here, you can quantify what the state gets back in return for this investment. The bad news is that, you know, we're a long ways from really being there today. We encourage you to do that. But I'd like to share with you, for instance, Currently, we are working with an area manufacturer in the Rochester area that is wanting to grow and expand into Rochester. Part of this proposal is to move some stuff from Pennsylvania and bring it into the Rochester site, which will be a reuse of an existing facility. And it's going to create hundreds of jobs for the Rochester area residents. And we're going to need the Job Z program because this company is going to have to justify this change or this move into Rochester as opposed to putting it into Chicago or Detroit. It's manufacturing. It's not Mayo. It's not IBM. Mayo and IBM account for over 60% of the jobs and the economy in the Rochester area. So if you take them out, we're a very small base. So the program, while you might think we don't need it, we really do need it as a tool to use to help us diversify and to grow our economic base and spread that out. The fine thing I would tell you that, we try to use this program in a way to build the economic base, and that is focus on those businesses that are selling their goods or services to customers that are located outside of the state of Minnesota. That transaction brings new dollars into the state's economy. We help grow the state economy. The jobs that are produced as a result of that are new value-added jobs. That's the way we've deployed that program in Rochester. The project I just told you about that we're working on will use up our last 5 acres of Job Z, so people can forget about Rochester being in the program, because as soon as we use the 5 acres, we're effectively out of the program at that point anyway. But I would implore you and encourage you to do what you can to make the changes that are necessary here, and to there is a way to calculate and measure the return on investment here, and you need to do that. The states should, citizens deserve no less than that.
Mr. Smith, it sounds like you probably have a good example of how this, from what you've told us, how it works. Maybe there's a way in this short period of window to work with Senator Rosen and other members of the Senate that are interested in this. I bet we all are interested, but right. And maybe with the commissioners and help, maybe we could use yours as kind of a you do and put it in legislation.
We'd love to work with you to do what we can to approve the effect. In fact, we've told the Department of Economic Development that the project we're working on, we're willing, even without withstanding law changes, to hold ourselves to a higher standard if it helps us move the ball forward.
We don't want you to go back to Rochester for about a week. Stay up here and help draft this.
We're willing to do what we can to
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for having Mr. Smith speak. Mr. Smith, thank you for your comments, because I think when we start wondering whether we've done the right thing with Job Z, and some of us have had those questions in the last couple of years, it's good to hear how it's working, and it was very helpful to know, that 60% of your jobs. I did not know that. I certainly knew they were a strong presence in Rochester, but that puts a whole different light on why Rochester's in it. So thank you for coming
that's
up
good.
Here and doing that.
Chairman, thank you, sir.
All right, there's a lot of work to be done. We're meeting Wednesday at what time, Brad? 12:30? And I'm intending on holding a hearing on the Delta Northwest Airlines merger next Monday. You can be, I've thought of about 500 questions, and if you guys want to be thinking about how that this is a major thrust in our area, and certainly we're all concerned. So that'll be Monday, and but in the meantime, Wednesday at 12:30, and try to be here on time.
Thank you.
Any